Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of QSR Uncut. I'm your host, Danny Klein, the editorial director here at QSR. And so this is a very special episode. I gotta be honest here up front, Matt Higgins. First of all, I don't know that we've ever had somebody who has been in this space quite, you know, to what you have. So that's exciting. And then also, I have seen you before on TV. I'm going to throw that out there, back in the old shark days. So,
you know, am I your first encounter with a shark in the wild?
That's a good question. So years ago, I talked to Barbara back in her many fast casual, investments. I cannot remember which one it was, but so you are the second, although you were the first that's ever been on the podcast. So we will give you that.
Barbara is the queen. So I defer.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe it was Cousins Maine Lobster, man. I can't remember. It was a while ago, but yeah, good times on that front. I've always been a big fan of the show, to be honest. So, so thank you for joining us, Matt, founder of RSE Ventures. So I'm going to give you a chance here, as I always do, to, you know, tell everybody a little bit about yourself, about the company, you know, things like that. I also heard you've got a book going on, so definitely feel free to tell us a little bit about what's happening there, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Sure. Yeah. All right. A few buckets. Yes, thank you about the book. I have a book called Burn the Boats, which actually tell a bunch of stories around QSR, fast casual, just my overall experience in the food industry. Partners with David Chang and Momofuku and Christina Tosi at Milk Bar and Pizza. So we can get into all that, but it's called Burn the Boats. So what am I? Let's just begin with the entity that has all these interests in the restaurant industry, and that's RSC Ventures, which is a partnership between myself and Stephen Ross. We're a broad-based consumer fund, not really a fund, honestly, more like a lab meets a fund meets a glutton for punishment. And we have done everything from incubating, partnering up with Gary Vaynerchuk and Ben Leventhal to create Resy back in the beginning, to investing like we did with Momofuku, to owning brands outright. We acquired Magnolia Bakery in the pandemic. So it runs from sports, entertainment, technology, basically whichever direction we want to take it. We've been together for 10 years, and it was born of my experience running NFL teams. I used to oversee the business of the New York Jets until I met Gary Vaynerchuk. And then I partnered with Stephen Ross to help him oversee the Miami Dolphins. And I served as vice chair. And then we launched RSC Ventures together.
You know, so I'm a recovering former sports writer. I've the best things in my life was the moment I left that industry. but what I always tell people is, you know, when I first started writing about restaurants, this was, I guess, 9 years ago, you know, there were actually, you know, some similarities, I thought, between, you know, the type of people, you know, that kind of live in both spheres, and in almost the sense that I think, you know, in sports, the success rate is so small for so many reasons. And it's kind of true in restaurants, too. So you tend to find a person who is, you know, incredibly passionate about what they do, because it's really the only explanation for why they would go through all the, you know, crap on the day to day that they have to, and all the challenges to be successful. So tell us a little bit about, you know, moving from one to the next, and what you saw, and how these things either were similar, or how different they were, or just kind of, I always liked the people in hospitality more than sports, is kind of where I was going with that. But what were your take on making the switch?
I like that we're like on the therapy couch now. So
that's what this is here.
Yeah, it really is. It requires us all to be on the couch for choosing to be in this industry. Yeah. So I like the way you framed it. Well, let me tell you the BS narrative I would give if I was making a PowerPoint presentation to a pension fund about why I'm in this space. So let me tell you that was the premise about why I entered into it. You know, when you have a great concept, and you have an someone who's a creator and had a vision for a fast casual or QSR, and they launched it, and they have had some success with, you know, 2, 3, 4 units, where a lot of them topple over is terrible real estate decisions, which are very hard to undo, right? You can change your menu, you can change your leadership, very hard to change your real estate. And so my thought was, I'm partners with one of the largest developers in the United States. If I could bring in that real estate expertise and help these concepts make better decisions, we could change the outcome. The reality is mixed to some extent. I provide advice on that front, but founders are going to go where founders want to go. And a lot of times they don't want to go in someone's mall just because you're an investor. And so I don't actually ever try, but that was the genesis at least. But the more important underlying point was helping founders scale, which has played out and which I do love. So what draws me to the industry is just how hard and utterly crazy it would be to attempt to scale these concepts. And I love that, for me at least, you know, food business in general exists at the intersection of art and finance, you know. And at the same time, you have to obviously make it viable by making it a business, but you need to preserve whatever it is that made it exquisite in the first place and made it scalable. And interesting, when you scale other types of products, you know, merchandise, clothing, you know, the attempt is to actually reduce the bespoke nature of it, right? So that it does scale, so that you can have more distribution, more touch points. When it's in food, you can't actually compromise on what it made exquisite in the first place, because then, you know, it stops scaling. Nobody cares anymore. So it's an attempt to reconcile scaling what makes something wonderful that existed in maybe one unit on a corner in the West Village and trying to take it national without screwing the whole thing up. So, and to your point about the people you meet are always just wonderful, soulful. Again, they had a vision that compelled them to quit their job and their life and to go all in. And so oftentimes it's just so gut-wrenching. I would say the most gut-wrenching experiences I have in business are in this space, for better or worse.
Yeah. I've been in NFL locker rooms, as I'm sure you have. And I never enjoyed that experience.
why? Now we got to go a little deeper. Let me double click on this. Why didn't you not enjoy it? Is it because?
Oh man. God, where to even begin? So this was the first time I ever went in an NFL locker room was the Jacksonville Jaguars hosting the Titans. And I just remember I had this kind of mentor guy. He used to work at Yahoo. Just kind of tell me, he was sitting outside the door and he's like, look, I just want to tell you before you go in there, Danny, like, this is not like the college sports you've covered before. You don't have, you know, PR and, you know, sports information directors to go, you know, set up these podiums for you to like sit and watch when you talk. You're going to go have to approach this guy who's probably, you know, he might be naked.
Yeah, right.
Fine, you know, whatever. But, you know, he might be weirdly naked in terms of like he wants everybody to look at this. And I'm like, what are we talking about now? And so I opened the door and, you know, sure enough, I mean, there's, it's like you see the different like defensive backs are in kind of like one area. And that's just a whole certain personality level and so on and so forth. And it was such a, just a wild, you know, west of like, let me walk in here and try not to, you know, I don't know where to go to, who I'm going to talk to, what he's going to say, you know, trying to.
This is one of the rituals I think about a lot. So to give context to the audience, right. And again, I oversaw NFL teams for God, 15 years in the business side. So this ritual that he's talking about, you know, post game, you know, this because you see it on TV, but you don't know what he's saying until you actually experience it. Like there's this small window where they're combining opening. It's called open the locker room, and you allow the press in. This is after the coach gives the wrap up speech to everyone. And which in itself is like tense and everyone's dehydrated and bruised and either pissed off or, you know, in adulation. And then these reporters have to come in who no one's interested in talking to, whether you're happy or not, obviously, because you are bruised, depressed, or happy and dehydrated. And then you have somebody coming up to you when you're half naked or naked with a towel on. Like, I wonder who thought that any of that was a good idea back in the day. Yeah. And I know it was born of the fact that these games are scripted with military precision as to when the game ends, when we're getting out of here, when we're getting on the plane, and all an attempt to get back, recover, watch the tape with the coaches will do all night long, you know, a day of recovery on Monday or whatever it is, and then back in it. So it's all about optimizing time. And so therefore this window, but in a parallel universe, somebody would be like, well, I mean, that's not the ideal environment to cut and conduct an interview. So let's get everybody dressed. And then we're going to create a 15-minute window before we leave the building to talk to reporters if it's important enough. Right. So yeah. It's just like somebody set it in motion. And I'm sure, because I've dealt with NFL coaches my whole life, it came out of the mind of a coach like, we got no time. We got to get back on the plane. We don't have time to talk to press. And so it was an accommodation. And I bet you, I wonder if you and I would be sitting when we're old and fishing, drinking Heinekens, and say, remember the day when they used to do that? That was crazy. Why would anybody want to conduct an interview? Bruised, dehydrated, half naked.
I hope so, because my prior experience of that in life at that time was, I had at the University of Florida, then and it was just so curated, almost to a negative degree, if you really talk about journalistic concepts, just because you all sat in this one room and you couldn't go in the locker room in college. It's kind of against the rules, I guess, but they would then send like one person out and
to the podium, probably, right? And then you would...
yeah, either to the podium or just like to the hallway with the basketball players, just to like and then you'd have 15 people talking to the same guy. You didn't even have to ask a question if you didn't want. It was a lot different than approaching the negative or the naked grown man in the corner of the NFL honestly, locker room.
If I were a player. And I'm not involved in a team at the moment, so I feel totally fine saying this. Like, I would resist that, saying like, look, I'll talk to press, create a window, and I'll do it. Or let's say, five players are designated because those players were most consequential in the game and the team designates it. Or, after the PR director talks to the press to say who's of most interest, and you send those five to the podium at the same time, they have to rush, get dressed quicker. Well, yeah. I'm with you. It doesn't make sense not to use our entire time together, but it's a fun. I've never had a conversation with anyone about it. And I would always think the same thing, like, who came up with this idea?
Yeah, well, we did.
And I was, by the way, I was a reporter. I don't know if you know this. I was an investigative reporter back in the day.
No.
I was a journalist and a little muckraker. So I'm very aware of your side. And I was also a press secretary to the mayor of New York. So I understand managing the needs of the press.
What were you investigating?
You don't realize that you have been subject to a 2-decade-long pursuit. It's like a RICO investigation.
Really boring.
Yeah, I know. But that's why I already knew you were pissed about the locker room routine. No, I was born in Queens, New York. And so I worked for a little weekly newspaper called Queens Tribune. But I would outkick my coverage, as they say, by making sure that whenever I had a great article, I would partner up with somebody from one of the dailies, or I would try to get on their radar, say, look what I found. I had a column and it was called the Trib Action Desk. And people would send me their seemingly mundane municipal problems. But oftentimes there was gold nuggets and they would morph into real investigative pieces. So I won a bunch of journalism awards when I was young.
That's a lot more ambitious than I was.
Actually, Bob Woodward at the time nominated me for a Pulitzer Prize which, by the way, you and I can nominate each other for a Pulitzer Prize. So it sounds better than.
Yeah, but me nominating you is not Bob Woodward nominating you.
Honestly, I would be honored. I would be honored if after this talk you would nominate me.
My newspaper career started at the St. Augustine Record in St. Augustine, Florida, which was people used to call it the mullet wrapper. And the only person who was proud of me working there was my father.
Wasn't that the one that had the logo, all the news that's fit to print? Am I thinking of a different one?
It was like one step below that. And so he used to carry it to go, when he would go to like AA meetings and show people, and they would all tell him like, none of us care about this newspaper, but you.
I remember when I was younger, and I thought I was all that, being a reporter for the Queens Tribune. I'd meet a girl like, I'm a reporter.
I remember doing that in the student newspaper as though anyone possibly cared.
Yeah, same thing. But looking back, it's funny how you think what you're doing at any one moment of time is important. We think right now probably what we're doing to someone is important, and we're going to find out later nobody cared.
True. Yeah, it's a positive outlook. But to your other point you made though about kind of the gut wrench in nature, the very first person I ever interviewed in this industry and the first assignment I was given was you might be familiar with this brand of Matchbox, kind of in the sphere of Ann Pizza down there in the DC area. But I was talking to one of the founders and he was taking a break from building the tables for the restaurant, like in his basement. You know, they were kind of just getting started out really with their growth, you know, and they ended up going bankrupt later in life. But I just remember thinking to myself, you know, how crazy is what you're doing? You know, that you're sitting there sawing this table downstairs so you could get this location open. You know, and that has always to me kind of defined the type of people in this industry. You know, and a lot of times it's hard for them, especially when you're talking about growing these brands to your point of trying to kind of maintain that magic. It's hard when you're not overseeing everything and building the table in the basement. You know, it is.
And I mean, my observations over the years from being involved in these brands, like why is it hard? And I think somebody who hasn't stepped into it, they hear it's hard and then you kind of gloss over why it's hard, or you're a narcissist and you think it won't be hard for you, or you're a sociopath and you don't really care about any of this. But in my general experience, if it's for a few reasons. One, there are so many factors that inform your ultimate success and they're impossible to track. And your success is as a result of so many cumulative factors that are only obvious to you after the fact. You get all this data. How are my COGS? Well, it's somewhat backward looking, right? Like, because you don't have a system, by the second to tell you, you know, what your COGS are looking like. COGS could be also affected by a couple of the units where somebody's being too generous, you know, with the toppings, or there's waste, or there's theft, right? And you have your real estate decisions, which you have to project how you're going to do. You know, and then you lock it in, right? And then your real estate should not be more than 10% of your gross revenue. But your revenue could drop with certain changes post COVID. Like, there's just so many factors that influence your ultimate success to get to a north of 20% four wall at a unit level. But I've always found those factors, you're getting data after the fact. You know, when the train has left the station. And then you're trying to move one of those levers and another one moved. It's a little bit like whack-a-mole, right? Like, all right, we're going to tackle our COGS this month. And like, damn, the weather, our revenue dropped. You know, it's just so remarkable. Yeah. And then the other challenge, I think, as a founder, usually a founder over-indexes on some core skill that gives them the permission to enter the space or the belief, right? They're great with food or a great chef or whatever it is. And then, of course, they have deficiencies elsewhere. So they're also always attempting to mitigate wherever their weaknesses are. And so self-awareness becomes a huge variable, right? Are you self-aware to realize, you know, you're not good at doing anything other than hammering that table? You know what I mean? And like you're, you know, or you can't handle friction or conflict. There's just so many variables that are unique when it comes to scaling a food concept. I mean, you use QSR. I always use QSR and fast casual somewhat interchangeably, but same thing.
Yeah, I was actually just on a panel where they asked me to explain the difference between the monikers. And my answer was that nobody cares but me.
Yeah, fair. By the way, I'm so glad you said that because I get anal retentive. Like, wait, I mean, should I use QSR or fast casual? Well, what is the difference?
I'll tell you. So it's even weirder for us because the fact that our publication is actually named QSR. So we can't use the term QSR in our reporting because, you know, somebody, it's almost like we would be talking about ourselves, even though I don't know that anyone would think that. That's just what was in the style book when I got here. So we spell it out. So it's got to say quick service restaurants versus QSR. Ooh, and what that means is that covers anything counter service, fast casual, and then also fast food. So we break up fast casual and fast food into two different categories. And most people call that LSR, which to me is even dumber, but I think was a reflection of not wanting to call it QSR, you know. And so what ends up happening is you have fast food, McDonald's, Wendy's, and then basically everybody else. But an interesting thing in the last, you know, 3 years, as I'm sure you could probably talk to this, is that the line between these two things is not quite what it once was. You know, Sweetgreen, Shake Shack, you know, they kind of operate like quote unquote QSRs now, just with a higher level of food and a higher price. But then you go to fast food and the price is still $12. So what does it even matter anymore? The answer is it doesn't.
I agree with that. I think the only place it would matter is that somebody who believes that they're fast casual might think they're more elevated and wouldn't want to be called QSR.
Correct.
That's probably it, right? Like somebody does not want to be equated with McDonald's when they're, you know, a more elevated proposition, right? But I think that's why I was like hesitating with this language. Like, I don't know the difference, but okay.
Yeah, I think fast casual as a term was entirely created for that reason alone. For people,
I do think and I think it was reflecting in a moment when it was sort of novel to have a Sweetgreens, right? Like, or Dig In or whatever, right? Like those things were not QSR, right.
Which just then became Dig, and we continue the confusing nature of what's going on here. But again, kind of circling back to what you said a minute ago, I was talking to someone recently about this, and the way that they put it is, if you're a founder, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, what things do you want to get off of your plate? You know, because all founders are the same, and that they tell you they wear 100 different hats and they're all overwhelmed and tired. And then you say to them, well, I'll take this, this, and this away, but then they don't want to actually get rid of those things.
I talk about that in my book. I tried to articulate the different forms of flawed leadership. And one of them is a martyr, which is a bootstrap founder usually who has developed an identity around their ability to do 100 things, but nobody does 100 things well. And I was saying that person ultimately fails because it doesn't scale. But that martyrs can be coached to realizing, like, your job as a founder is to render yourself obsolete and as many jobs as possible. That's winning. Is if you look around and be like, woof, man, Sally is infinitely better than I ever could be. And then you're happy about it. And that is, that all rolls up to the idea of think like an owner. If you want to be successful, especially in this space when, like, everything is on the line because you're trying to scale in all sorts of multiple domains that you're just not an expert in, real estate, logistics, operations, supply chain, you thinking like an owner is moving as fast as possible to fire yourself in these different areas once you have the money and the yield and hire the person who's better. And that's the number one flaw I see across business generally. It's just people who don't think like an owner and think like, how do I render myself obsolete?
Yeah, I have that problem sometimes on a much, much smaller scale, since obviously I'm not a owner, but I do have trouble delegating at times because I came from a world where I had to do everything, and I have to trust the people that I now manage to do the things that I used to do, even if they do them differently.
Well, I think it's okay to have trouble delegating. It's what makes it hard is when your identity and self-worth is tied up with the idea that you do everything well. And that person becomes very resistant to making the transition. Most people don't want to delegate because delegation takes time and you have to be more strategic and can't be tactical, right? You got to, all right, I got to step back. I got to train this person. Like, I don't want to do that either. But I don't have a psychological resistance to it because my identity is not wrapped up in me doing everything, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. So kind of on that same topic of, you know, if you are a fast casual, and this, you know, this is a very interesting investing dynamic right now in the industry. From people I talk to, getting loans from banks is just a hard thing to do. But, you know, the other negative of getting a loan from a bank, in my opinion, if you're a restaurateur, is that, you know, you're getting money and nothing else. You know, we talked about Shark Tank. I think one of the benefits of working with certain investor partners in the space is actually having someone connected enough to help you versus just, here, take this money and figure out what to do with it. You know, even though you kind of go the way you got to go sometimes. But, you know, kind of the question being, if you are a fast casual or a QSR, whatever, and you're looking to kind of think about this point, I mean, what are some of the kind of like the check boxes you might be at where you would say, okay, well, I might need an investor now, or this might be a good idea for me, or, you know, maybe I should take care of this before I go approach, you know, Matt Higgins, or, you know, things of that nature. I mean, how do you kind of know when it's time?
Great question. I think the threshold question is, taking that money in comes with a heavy price, loss of autonomy, right? It comes with benefits, obviously, but it comes with a lot of compromises. So there's no point even entertaining it if you don't have a scalable concept that there's a yield. And so I think the base case is like, is this unit throwing off more than 20%, you know, four wall, right? Is this a unit that works in multiple places? Do I want to have the kind of life where I have to oversee multiple units? Or am I happy with the money that I'm making and things throwing off $1.2 million and it's feeding my family and I like my life and I don't, you know, am I the kind of person that can oversee multiple units, right? Do I have the right personality? Do I have the personality to work with a partner who has the ability to approve my budget now, right? And so I think one is setting the foundation and asking yourself the really tough questions about does this scale and do I scale as a leader? And then, you know, the answer is yes. And then the question is, okay, well, even so, what if I were to take the go slow and steady approach, and I would just bank the, you know, the contribution, put it and accumulate enough to fund the build out myself. You know, let's say your build out is $400,000 and your unit is throwing out 200 grand a year and you're a trust fund child. And so you could put that all away. All right. Well, in 2 years, 2.5 years, you can build your second unit, which, by the way, I would argue, I think everyone, if possible, should build their second or third unit with accumulated savings. And a lot of times, like, well, I'm on the clock. Somebody's going to steal my coconut water, you know, drive-through concept. And so I better get going with it. I like making fun of coconut water. And yeah, so
sounds like a horrible idea.
Exactly. That's so I would argue to anyone here listening, try to build your second or third unit yourself, because you'd rather prove to yourself that you and your concept have what it takes to scale, rather than with an investor giving you a hard time for their 2 year payback, you know? Yeah. So that's, you know, a set of dynamics. And then if you are going to take in money, realize that this is a big mistake I see folks make. They take in capital, and then they you know, take on overhead, and then they aren't ready to deploy the capital efficiently. And everything takes, you know, 9 months to get a unit, identify the unit, build out the unit, open the unit, right? So you're kind of on the clock with that capital, and which is why I hate debt, and I'll get to that in a second. So you better be sure that you take in only as much as necessary, is that you can deploy it as quickly as possible, because you're going to burn that money with your G&A. Because once you start taking in more capital to build more units, you're going to take on G&A in IT, real estate, supply chain. So if you don't get leverage out of that burn, now that money is just going nowhere. So why do I hate debt in particular? I really hate debt in this industry. First of all, it's impossible to get. Only during this window of time when there was free money was suddenly, you know, debt was available. It's because if you take on debt and you don't use that debt to open units as quickly as possible, now you have debt service, right? You didn't efficiently spend that money, and you have a concept that's very, very hard to get equity now, because that equity sits behind the debt. And most people don't want to sit behind a lot of debt, because this is not a venture business where you can get exponential growth. This isn't ChatGPT where, you know, you can still have the same 10 employees and you 100 extra revenue, right? So when you have debt, especially, you have to so perfectly align growth with that debt, or else you find you burn through a lot of that capital and you can't raise new equity.
And then you end up going public.
That's not available right now. And the problem is with this industry, QSR, fast casual, the multiples compress pretty dramatically, violently during downtimes. And we're in one of those times, right? Where things were trading at, you know, 3x top line. Yeah. And now that's compressed dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, talk about the current times, so to speak. I mean, I was talking to someone about this the other day, and you know, they're in a capital space, and you know, M&A right now is almost non-existent. I mean, there's just not a lot of it happening compared to 2 or 3 years ago, and a lot of that probably had to do with debt and some of these brands trying to get out of their own concepts, but. Yeah, I mean, what is it like out there right now in the investment space? It seems pretty convoluted to me, but definitely an interesting time for sure.
I think it's, I would use the word paralyzed would be the word I would describe it, because, and waiting for the other shoe to drop. So you have all these headwinds, which anyone listen to this in this industry already knows, right, around inflation. And so you have inflation, you have labor, you have a redistribution of work, right? To suburbs and exurbs away from, you know, main corridor, main cities. And you have all these headwinds, shift to delivery, etc. And at the same time, that is showing up in lower, you know, AUV, and obviously lower contribution at the unit level. And so therefore, if you're an investor looking at this dispassionately, you're like, my payback period is going to be a lot longer on build out. It's going to be a lot harder to get any kind of venture return. A lot of the concepts, if they've already raised debt, that makes it less interesting, and messy cap tables. I do think we're in a tough time. I mean, it all started with COVID, but not just because COVID, you know, disrupted these businesses. It's because COVID disrupted work. COVID disrupted cost of goods, and COVID elevated labor. And yet it's not like people suddenly were more willing to pay more. You know, like that didn't change, right? So you don't have more pricing power. So long way of saying, I think it's a really tough time. And unlike tough times on angel investing, for example, I'm actually writing a lot of angel checks because anything born of this vintage to me is an opportunity. It shows you a founder fought through those headwinds, and those deals are just as interesting as they were 2 years ago, right? But in our space, QSR, they're not as interesting as they were 2 years ago because of these incremental headwinds. So there is a lot of reckoning happening at the moment. Not to be overly negative, I'm just giving you the truth.
No, I mean, I think I was talking to someone last week, and you know, his basic idea or you know, theme was that it's in worse shape than some of the things that you're reading. You know, that and a lot of that is happening in QSR because it's kind of the blue collar side that's really struggling. In manufacturing and things like this are all probably 6 months behind, at least according to him. You know, and that's really causing some headwinds in what people are spending, you know. And I just wrote this McDonald's story yesterday where, you know, the idea is that they're losing people who are making $40,000 and less a year. And if McDonald's is not attracting that consumer, you know, I think the industry as a whole, I recognize it has a little bit of a problem.
By the way, I do a lot on stock and derivatives. I say stay close to the market just because I just like to get, you know, have a touch. That McDonald's report is the canary in the mine in a lot of ways. Americans are laboring under an extraordinary amount of debt. Like, and just because labor has been able to stay pretty strong, 3.7% unemployment. If you look at the history of the interplay between interest rates and unemployment, you know, it's about a year and a half ago, before the rates were jacked up aggressively, there was a tons of reports from economists who said, if the Fed is to get inflation down to 2%, unemployment will rise higher than 5%. That hasn't happened yet. And I just think it's because of the contrails of free money lasted a little bit longer than anyone of us realized. But the consumer is feeling the pain because of $1 trillion of credit card debt. And you're seeing defaults on auto loans unprecedented levels. And so the fact that McDonald's, which is supposed to be a safe harbor in a downturn, you know, is feeling the pinch is just a leading edge. And I think you're right, back to QSR. They were sort of feeling it anyway. But I think the only area differs, I think they were feeling it because of all these other pressures. I don't think there's been as much pressure on top line. I think the top line pressure is also coming. And so that might, McDonald's is a big warning.
Well, McDonald's has been growing the top line. I think it's 30% in 3 years, right? but they haven't done it through guest counts. And, you know, eventually that's the type of thing that is going to start to roll into other places. And they're, you know, in the same boat as, you know, I was doing Chipotle yesterday, but, you know, this California thing, right? And it's like, they're not really going to get cheaper, you know? And so if they're going to start to, you know, pulse these kind of crazy promotions to have transactions go up, and now the margins become an issue, and then the labor that you spoke about becomes even more of an issue. If you got to pay $20 in California and, you know, or you would be paying $17 elsewhere. I mean, no one really knows what these numbers are anymore. And it's going to create just all sorts of, you know, interesting technology investments for one. But then how much of those cost the franchisees? I mean, you see Burger King right now is spending, you know, they spent $1 billion to acquire 1,000 restaurants so that they can essentially remodel them and refranchise them. Which is a pretty good sign too, as well, to what you're saying.
Yeah, I think actually what's going to start happening, and this is not a very well formed thought, but the regulatory environment, which is always slow to realize that people have the power to vote with their feet now, unlike before, where capital was a little bit captive, especially New York, my hometown. There's always a feeling, well, it's always going to be the capital of the world, so we have monopoly pricing power, right? Which in the 90s, that crime proved that was not true. People fled for crime. There's a different dynamic at work now, which is all capital is mobile. And municipalities are going to be late to realizing, especially California, no, you don't have the ability and right to tax people to oblivion, to regulate small businesses and restaurants out of business. They will vote or they will die. But I think what you're going to find is clusters where businesses do work based upon the climate of the government. So let's use Nashville as an example. If I were to, somebody were to pitch me a concept that was born in Nashville, you know, what's that hot chicken one? I just went there the other day.
Dave's.
Yeah, yeah. Or yeah, the other spicy chicken one is homegrown. They have like 5 units. I'm forgetting what the name of it is.
Yeah, there's about 30 of them.
Right. Yeah, not Dave's. It was this other one. But my point being, there are going to be these clusters within Florida, Nashville, Texas, you know, Minnesota, weirdly, because Minnesota's resistant to climate change. Like, there are places where things work that they don't work elsewhere that create for very fine businesses that could have, you know, 20 to 30 units. And I think anyone in this industry has to think long and hard about having a very specific geographic strategy that can outlast these tailwinds and no longer look at the country as a place for like, I'm going to expand nationally. No, you should expand to these markets, which can push back against these dynamics. And I'm just throwing out Nashville as a great case study. Very long Nashville.
Yeah. I'm actually going to be in Nashville in 3 weeks for a conference.
Very long Nashville, very long Miami.
Yeah. I grew up in New York and then I left when I was 18 and never went back. And
yeah, look, I'm still here. My headquarters is here. My apartment's here. I mean, I love New York. It's sad to see what's happened, but it is the perfect case study of like what happens when you take, you know, your economy for granted, your people for granted. You think you could tax to oblivion. You can't anymore.
I know. I grew up in Brooklyn, which I went back about 3 months ago, and it's like a whole different state.
Yeah,
like nothing like what I grew up in. I mean, I hadn't been back in years, and I, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say for the worse, but it was just a whole different place.
Yeah, no, I think Brooklyn is a bright spot in New York, especially Williamsburg and whatnot. But even that, they'll feel the pinch because the tax base is fleeing. The problem is the tax base is fleeing if it can, and that's where it's gonna show up. But the good thing is, 20 years from now, what's interesting is all municipalities will be competing against each other for a favorable regulatory business environment because they can't withstand the flight of capital since this remote phenomenon is not going away. And that's actually healthy. Governments should compete. I mean, I'm putting my government hat on. Government should be compete. And a lot of times when you have people who work in government, they never had to earn a buck. And it's like, you don't even know what the F you're talking about. Like, you never had to earn money. Like, you're a bureaucrat. And so I think being forced to compete is the only way you could teach a bureaucrat, you know, what it takes.
Yeah, the world needs to be led by more people who started out at small newspapers. That's my takeaway.
There you go. That's the big takeaway. All the news is fit to print or whatever it is.
You gotta go walk into a football locker room at least once before you're allowed to to go out there into the public. But Matt, before I let you go, though, I want to kind of open the floor to you know, tell us, you know, something that maybe we didn't bring up before that you think is important to get out there into the world. You know, what maybe is sort of the theme of this year for you, or
I'll talk about how I approach investing and what I'm passionate about and the purpose of the book. And this really does apply to particularly in this folks in this industry that I think the fish rots from the head. The Italians have a great line. I won't say it in Italian, but it's a fish rots from the head, which is basically all the problems that you could see that show up downstream in any business, I could trace back to the leader. And the way to be an effective leader, especially when you're scaling, because now the measure of the game is different. Do I scale and does this scale? The question, do I scale? In order to scale, you really have to embrace self-awareness. Because self-awareness, people who are self-aware as leaders don't require someone else to intervene when you're doomed, like you're about to die. And so I would say to anyone out there who's listening and who's trying to take on expansion and multiple businesses, you got to look in the mirror and just say, am I truly receptive to evolving as a person and as a leader? And am I attempting to mitigate where I'm weak? And so what I did with my book was to try to do in sometimes cringy detail, demonstrate that all of us have some metaphorical boat to burn with burn the boats. A lot of times it has to do with anxiety or imposter syndrome or shame. For me, it was growing up poor and trying to conceal everything I came from. The bottom line is we all have metaphorical boats that hold us back as leaders. And that if you attack those, that you will realize it's going to show up downstream in your business. So to make that less abstract, if you're a martyr, because you're operating, you're leading like a martyr and you're taking it all on yourself, you might be acting that way because you can't handle conflict. You can't handle the friction of telling someone else they suck at their job. And that might be because you grew up in a family where no one was allowed to say what was really on their mind. I mean, I'm getting all psychological. So my advice to anyone out there, and I wrote the book this way, is to demonstrate how passionate I am about psychology and about, and not in like a soft way, you know, because we need to, you know, self-love. It's because it makes you much more effective in business. And so if you read the book, you'll see infinite case studies about those who had to burn some metaphorical boat in order to reach their full potential. There's 50 different case studies. I'm partners with Scarlett Johansson in a business. I'm Rex Ryan at the NFL context. I tried to show different context. And then I tried to show myself about even going on Shark Tank, how I had to overcome imposter syndrome in order to perform on that show. And it's a detail I didn't really want to share. I'd much prefer everyone listening to this think I'm a natural, but I did it because the biggest thing I find when I'm dealing with a leader as they're trying to scale is they think their impulse is concealment when it should be confrontation. Don't try to conceal the thing that's holding you back as a leader to scale, confront it. And then when you do, everything begins to change and you unlock. So not to leave you with such a psychological discourse, but it really is. It's where everything is. And the Italians got it right. The fish rots from the head.
I randomly have a minor in psychology, which I did at the time because I just thought it would be easier. But it has, you know, it does come in handy once in a while. I won't pretend that I learned a ton in that program. But you know, I hear what you're saying because, you know, sometimes I kind of growing up without a lot of money, I feel like it makes you feel like you just never have money even when you do.
And it's I have the same problem right now. Honestly, I call it my inner catastrophizer. I had to name it because it invents new and creative ways in which I'm still going to get screwed. And like one might argue that I've achieved some measure of wealth, presumably, right? You know, being on Shark Tank and whatnot. If you were in my brain, you'd be like, damn. I'm still always imagining new ways in which I'm doomed. And that's psychological, right? If I was sitting on the chair, if you were a psychiatrist, you'd be like, we got to work on that.
I know. In the same way, I got asked the other day, like, you know, these very general, what motivates you questions. I was on this podcast and I was like, honestly, I'm just always afraid to mess up. I live by the existence of trying to not do a bad job. I'm just like, I eventually hopefully stop thinking that way. But there is some element of me, like in any project I go into, and we threw a conference last year for the first time. And at the very beginning, I was just like, you know, this has to work because I don't know what happens if it doesn't. More so than like, I'm really excited for this new opportunity. It was just this idea of like, I'm scared to death, so I'm going to try as hard as possible.
I meditate on that all the time. I talk to my wife about this. Like, I just want to experience the joy of pursuit for the outcome, not for fear of the opposite of it. And I get asked this a lot of times. I talk about self-awareness and they're like, all right, Matt, but like, how do you cultivate self-awareness or how do you push it downstream? You and I just did that right now. Not rather than telling, like, you should be self-aware, you showed it. You said about the conference, right? You illustrated it. Everyone listening right now can relate to this emotion. We've created space for others to be vulnerable. So my book is an exercise in trying to do that at scale of saying, like, most success happens in spite of, not because of. You are successful in spite of the fact that you are trying to outrun this fear of failure or poverty. I am successful in spite of the lingering trauma of being unable to save my mother from death. You know what I mean? The lingering trauma of ending up back in eviction court or eating government cheese, which is what I grew up on, right? Like, so I wanted to, with the book, demonstrate, if you accept the fact that we're mostly concealing whatever it is in spite of that we're working through, if you reveal it, you create space for your leaders, managers, and people below you to go ahead and do the same. I'll give you a quick story in the book. Rex Ryan, this sounds quaint and nuts in 2024, but back when I worked at the Jets, Rex was quote unquote outed for having a foot fetish about
his friend. I remember that well. Sadly.
Right. So I managed this PR crisis with Rex, and I don't think I tell the full story in the book, but I'll tell you now. When this first happened, Rex was devastated, and I love Rex Ryan, coach of the team. And there was all this salacious speculation. It was the front page of the Post, front page of all across America about this foot fetish, right? And I remember seeing Rex, who was devastated. And I was like, I walk in the room and he's with our head of PR, who's very religious. And they had just finished praying. And I said, Rex, you know, you pray? And he goes, I do now. And I said, but he was like upset. And he's like, Matt, what are we going to do? I said, Rex, we're going to go on Oprah and we're going to get a 5-book deal. He goes, what are you talking about? I said, Rex, you know how amazing it is that after 20 something years with your wife, you still find her feet so hot. Like we're going to monetize this and we're going to go on a foot fetish tour. And there's a couple of reasons why I love that story, because number one, when someone's in crisis, like you go on a step on the train and forward them. Two, you want to take the temperature down. Three, to this day, when I see Rex all the time, he goes, here's Oprah. But most importantly, once he decided to own it, what happened, something was remarkable with the team. The players were like, man, Rex, I loved it about you. You're like a real guy. Like you got, they actually rallied around him. Yeah. They wrapped around them, not just to like lift him up. They rallied around him because he lowered themselves, and everyone has some idiosyncrasy or shame. Mm-hmm. And they all come from tough places. And so I share that story in the book. One, it's funny, but also to show the catalytic effect of modeling vulnerability in ways that are not just stupid catchwords, but actually have a massive impact. That outing and that scandal elevated Rex 10x in the locker room.
So is your book out now? I mean, in terms of like where people could go get it?
Yeah, it's Burn the Boats. It's on Amazon. It's a Wall Street Journal bestseller. If you happen to read it, let me know and DM me on LinkedIn. I read every comment.
Yeah, I was going to say one more kind of personal story to that conference I was mentioning before. So the keynote for that was the CEO of Chick-fil-A, and he, you know, it was such a crazy thing from start to finish in terms of, you know, when I asked him to do it, I never thought that he was going to agree to do it. And they agreed within about a week. And, you know, I remember from that moment, and then it was 8 months after that, that entire time, my whole fear was, is he going to show up?
Yep. Story of my life.
You know, so the night before, you know, I'm nervous. I go out there and, you know, they're like, what are you nervous about? You know, this is we sold this out by over, you know, 240 people than what we had planned and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what if I walk out on the stage and he's just not there? You know, and they're like, why are you even saying this? And, you know, so then the moment I got there and he was waiting at the desk or, you know, like the table in front of the stage, you know, that's just one of those feelings I'll always remember because to your earlier point, it was like, I was more relieved than like, yep, here he is. This is going to be awesome. I was just like, oh, thank God, you know, and then it went on and everything was really good, but it would be nice at some point in my life where I can enjoy these things in real time instead of the fear of them going catastrophically bad. So maybe I will read your book.
Yeah, but I've come to believe that for most people, the joy of living is in the striving and not in the actual attaining. And so I've come reconciled with the elusive fact that I don't know if I will ever experience joy for the attainment. And the only joy, you know, to stay with this, setting aside love and children and all the things that mean the world to me, I have experience with the joy in this book in a way I've never experienced in my life, and actually self-respect in a way that I've never experienced. And that I tried to engineer a result with this book and hold up a mirror to human potential. And there's certain people in the world I imagined that I imagined them unsupported. I imagined them stifled by people around them or undermined. I imagined them being me, the little kid, you know, high school dropout, kind of abandoned and watching my mother slowly die, nobody caring. I wanted to reach that person and through the book, have them feel like, oh, you held up a mirror. I can do something now. No bullshit. I wake up to a DM every day from somebody around the world who has had that reaction. Yeah. That is the most successful I've ever felt in my life. Like
that's cool.
Like breathtaking. Like I am so, and I experience joy, not in egotistical, in a, I did something meaningful on this earth that mattered. And I use the moral authority I've collected by being on Shark Tank, teaching at Harvard, all this stuff. But I use it in a way that mattered more than anything I could, that I could ever have conceived. And that is to slightly change the trajectory of somebody's life.
Yeah.
Not, you know, and so to your point, like, I don't know if I'll ever experience it in other contexts, but at least I got to experience that through the book.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah. I mean, I've kind of come to embrace that's one of the reasons I'm able to be successful, is that I'm sort of driven by something elemental like that, you know, and I kind of have to accept it but right. but it definitely helps, because the thing is, like, even in that scenario, I mean, I had asked Chick-fil-A to be on our cover for like 6 straight years, so I put in years of failing before I was successful. And that just kind of is typically how I operate. And
I'm constantly debating, trying to understand what's the difference between persistence and madness. And as I'm going through something that everyone around me is like, dude, let it go. It's like over. And then I have all these case studies, including some I talk about in the book, where I didn't let it go. And the mere act of refusing to die really changed the universe. And so I'm constantly... But even in those moments, I put so much energy into analyzing whether this persistence or madness that by the time it worked out, I bypassed the joy. And I'm like,
I hear you on that.
I bet you if a therapist is listening to this, like, guys, both of you, you have some undiagnosed real trauma.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I tell I've been living in the South now for a while. And I'm always like, you know, everyone in New York has been to therapy. So I was in therapy. My brothers were in therapy. You know, that's just what happens in New York City. So,
yeah, here we are, though, still populating this podcast with things that are very unreconciled.
I know, a lot of good it did,
but a lot of good it did.
Well, Matt, thank you so much. This has been awesome. You know, I I would say one of the more different ones we've done in the 120 episodes I've recorded. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share all this with you, and, you know, for talking about your book. And I think I'm going to go give it a read. So
amazing. Thank you. I'm happy to send you a copy as well. So, but I appreciate it. And, and anyone out there, just connect with me on LinkedIn, and you happen to read the book, just DM me. It sustains me, makes me do, you know, pursue it another day. So thank you. And I enjoyed our crazy meandering chat. That started with NFL locker rooms.
Are the best type of podcast.
Yeah, it started with NFL locker rooms and ended with Psycho Babble. This is perfect.
True. All right. Well, for everybody out there who's listening, as always, we appreciate it.